Council there, who is Carter's drug policy man, fortunately charged at the time with finding solutions more effective than punishment. He told them that his client had fallen off the wagon, had a medical problem. Bill was asking their mercy to grant me a special visa to come to the United States. Why the United States and not Borneo? Well, there was only one woman who could cure me, and she was called Meg Patterson, and she did a black box cure with electric vibrations. She was in Hong Kong and needed a sponsor doctor in the United States. These were the lengths Bill Carter went to, and it worked. Miraculously, his White House contacts instructed immigration to grant me a visa, and he got permission from the Canadian court for me to fly to the United States. We were allowed to rent a house in Philadelphia, where Meg Patterson would treat me every day for 3 weeks. From there, after her prescribed cure, we moved to Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I was not allowed to move outside a 25-mile radius from Philadelphia, which included Cherry Hill. A deal worked out between the doctors and lawyers and the immigration department. This wasn't so great for Marlon, however. They let him in to clean up, which is when we went to New Jersey. And I lived with this doctor's family, this very religious family. That was actually the most traumatic thing, moving from this hotel with all the stones and everyone into this house in New Jersey with a right-wing Christian American family, a white picket fence and skateboards. And I started going to an American school where you had to say prayers every day. That was really shocking. And I would go and visit Keith and Anita, who were down the road every few days. I couldn't wait to get out of there. I was a right brat, I think. This family thought I was wild. I had long hair. I didn't wear shoes. I barely ever wore clothes. I used the worst language you can imagine for a 7-year-old. And I think they were just very pitying of me. It was a bit pathetic. I didn't like that family at all. They were trying to turn me into a good little American boy, and I'd never been to America. I still thought America was full of bloody Indians. Loads of buffalo wandering around, and suddenly I was in New Jersey. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be scalped if I go outside. Although I was getting clean under Meg Patterson's care, a cure imposed by the authorities lacks conviction in the heart. Meg's method was supposed to be the painless way out. Electrodes attached to your ear released endorphins, which theoretically cancelled the pain. Meg also believed in alcohol. In my case, Jack Daniels, which is a strong brew, as a substitute, a diversion, let's say. So I drank heartily under Meg's maternal guidance. I was quite interested in Patterson's method. It did certainly help, but it was still no fun. After it was finished, in a matter of 2 weeks or so, immigration announced that they'd have to monitor me for another month. I'm clean, all right? And I'm getting antsy and restless, stuck in this nice suburb. I felt like I was in jail. I just got sick of it. Meg Patterson made a report to the State Department and Immigration that I was following the medical treatment. And to cut a long story short, I got reinstated. As far as immigration was concerned, the slate was wiped clean. No offences appeared on my record. Times were different then. There was more of a belief in rehabilitation than there is now. The visa which was originally a medical visa, overrode everything. It was extended from 3 to 6 months, from single to multiple entries. There were waivers for touring and working on the grounds that I was confirmed as clean and curing myself. As you clean up, you go up another level and another until you get to full clean status, according to my understanding of it. And I've always been very grateful to the US government for allowing me to come to America to get help to come off the stuff. So we sprung Marlin and moved out of New Jersey to a rented house in South Salem, New York, called Frog Hollow. A classic colonial-style wooden house, although haunted, according to an increasingly haunted Anita, who saw the ghosts of Mohican Indians patrolling the hilltop. It was down the road from George C. Scott. He used to crash regularly into a white wooden fence, pissed out of his brain, drive it at 90 miles an hour. But that's where we ended up, near Mount Kisco in Westchester County. It was at this time that Jane Rose, who is now my manager, started unofficially looking after me. Jane was working mostly for Mick, but Mick had asked Jane to stay in Toronto and help me when everybody left. And she's still here, my secret weapon, 30 years later. I have to say that during the bust in Toronto, in fact, during all busts, Mick looked after me with great sweetness, never complaining. He ran things. He did the work and marshaled the forces that saved me. Mick looked after me like a brother. Jane described herself at this time as the meat in the sandwich between Mick and me. She witnessed the first sign of a rift between us when I came out of the junk fog and the mental fog that accompanies it, and started to want to take care of business, at least musical business. Mick would come up to Cherry Hill and hear my selection of tracks for Love You Live, which we'd been working on all this time, sporadically. And he'd go back and bitch to Jane about them. Collaboration was giving way to struggle and disagreement. It's a 2-disc album, and the result is that one disc was Mick's and the other was mine. I started talking about things, about business, things we had to settle, which I imagine for Mick was unfamiliar, shocking. I'd kind of risen from the dead after the will had been read. But this was a skirmish, a sign only of what was to come in later years. It took 19 months from the bust in March 1977 in Toronto to the trial in October 1978. But at least now I was living in striking distance of New York. The visas were, of course, not without conditions. I had to travel back and forth to Toronto for various hearings. I had to prove that I'd cleaned up and had been following a steady course of rehab. And I was obliged to attend psychiatric evaluation and treatment in New York. I had this doctor in New York City who would say, "Oh, thank God you're here. I've been dealing with other people's brains all day." She would open the drawer and pull out a bottle of vodka. She'd say, "Let's sit here for half an hour and have a drink. You look all right." I'd say, "I'm feeling pretty good." But she helped me. She was doing her job. She made sure the program worked. John Phillips called me one day, and when I was in South Salem and said, I've got one. Get your ass down here and I'll show you. Proof positive, I've got one. He was into the coke bugs. I thought, I'll drive down, give my friend a hand, you know, if he's got one. People have been calling him mad for weeks because he was convinced that he was infected by bugs. So I went down there and he pulled out a napkin, a Kleenex with a little bloody hole in it. See? I've got one. John, are you serious? You'll have to reconsider, baby. And I'd driven an hour and a half down there to see. He'd picked himself to bits. I mean, he was covered in scabs. But this time, he was convinced he'd got one. He looked at the Kleenex and said, oh shit, it got away. John had taken over a pharmacy. Who didn't in those days? Freddie Sessler used to own drugstores. And John was in a state. In the bedroom, he had a medical bed, one of those bendy beds. Only a half of it worked. His mirror in the John was held together with gaffer tape. It was a shattered image any way you looked at it. Needles were stuck in the wall where he'd used them as darts. But we'd play, never starting before midnight, sometimes not until 2 a.m. with other musicians. I survived that without smack. John's solo project was stopped by Armin Ertegun because John was in no condition to go on. The sessions for some girls always had a following wind from the moment we started rehearsing in the strangely shaped Pathé Marconi studios in Paris. Oh, it was a rejuvenation, surprisingly, for such a dark moment, when it was possible that I would go to jail and the Stones would dissolve. But maybe that was part of it. Let's get something down before it happens, you know. It had an echo of Beggar's Banquet about it. A long period of silence and then coming back with a bang and a new sound. You can't argue with 7 million copies and 2 top 10 singles out of it. Miss You and Beast of Burden. Nothing was prepared before we got there. Everything was written in the studio day by day. So it was like the earlier times at RCA in Los Angeles in the mid-60s. Songs pouring out. Another big difference from recent albums was that we had no other musicians in with us. No horns, no Billy Preston. Extra stuff was dubbed later. If anything, the build-up of Sidemen had taken us down a different path in the 70s, away from our best instincts on some occasions. So the record was down to us, and it being Ronnie Wood's first album with us, down to our guitar weaving on tracks like Beast of Burden. We were more focused, and we had to work harder. The sound we got had a lot to do with Chris Kimsey, the engineer and producer who we were working with for the first time. We knew him from his apprenticeship at Olympic Studios, and so he knew our stuff backwards. And he would, on the basis of this experiment, engineer or co-produce 8 albums for us. We had to pull something out. Not make another Stones in the Doldrums album. He wanted to get a live sound back and move away from the clean and clinical sounding recordings we'd slipped into. We were in the Pathé Marconi studios because they were owned by EMI, with whom we just made a big deal. This one was way on the outskirts of town in Boulogne-Billancourt, near the Renault factory. Nothing around like restaurants or bars. It was a car ride, and I remember I was listening to Jackson Browne's Running on Empty on a daily commuter basis. At first, we'd booked into this enormous rehearsal studio like a soundstage, with a tiny control room that fitted barely two people, and with a primitive 1960s console and a basic 16-track. The shape was odd because the console faced the window and a wall which held the speakers, but the wall went off at an angle, so one speaker was always farther away from you than the other during playbacks. The adjoining studio had a much bigger desk and generally more sophisticated equipment, but for the moment, we got playing in this warehouse, sitting around in a semicircle, fencing off space with screens. We hardly went into the control room for the first few days. Wasn't enough space. Kimsey spotted immediately that this studio had truly great sound properties. Because it was a rehearsal room, we'd rented it cheap, which was lucky because we spent a long time on this record and never moved into the proper studio next door. The primitive mixing desk turned out to be the same kind of soundboard designed by EMI for Abbey Road Studios. Very humble and simple. Barely more than a treble and bass button, but with a phenomenal sound, which Kimsey fell in love with. Uprooted relics of these desks are apparently museo collector's items. The sound it got had clarity, but dirtiness, a real funky club feel to it that suited what we were doing. It was a great room to play in. So, despite Mick doing his usual, "Let's move to a proper studio," that's where we stayed. Because in a recording session, especially with this kind of music, everything has to feel good. There's no swimming upstream. You're not salmon. We're looking to glide. And if you've got problems with room, you start to lose confidence in what's going to be captured by the microphones, and you start shifting things about. You know it's a good room when a band is smiling. What a lot of Some Girls was down to was this little green box I used. This MXR pedal, a reverb echo. For most of the songs on there, I'm using that, and it elevated the band, and it gave it a different sound. In a way, it came down to a little bit of technology. It was kind of like Satisfaction, a little box. On Some Girls, I just found a way of making that thing work, at least through all the fast songs. And Charlie was on with it. And Bill Wyman, too, I've got to say. There was a certain sense of renewal. A lot of it was, we've got to outpunk the punks. Because they can't play, and we can. All they can do is be punks. Yes, that might have been a certain thorn in the side. The Johnny Rottens, these fucking kids, you know. I love every band that comes along. That's why I'm here, to encourage guys to play and get bands together. But when they're not playing anything, they're just spitting on people. Ah, come on, we can do better than that. There was also an extra urgency because of this grim prospect of the trial, and also because after all the palaver, the bust, the noise, the cleaning up, I needed to prove that there was something behind all this, some purpose to this kind of suffering. And it came together very nicely. Because we hadn't been together for a while, we needed to get back our old form of writing and collaborating, doing it all on the day, there and then, composing from scratch or semi-scratch. We jumped straight in, back to our old ways, with remarkable results. Before They Make Me Run and Beast of Burden were basically collaborations. When The Whip Comes Down, I did the riff. Mick wrote it, and I looked around and said, shit, he's finally written a rock and roll song by himself. Some Girls was Mick. Lies too. Basically, he'd say, I've got a song, and then I'd say, well, what if we do it this way or that way? We didn't think much of Miss You when we were doing it. It was, Mick's been to the disco and has come out humming some other song. It's a result of all the nights Mick spent at Studio 54 and coming up with that beat, that four on the floor. And he said, add the melody to the beat. We just thought we'd put our oar in on Mick wanting to do some disco shit. Keep the man happy. But as we got into it, it became quite an interesting beat. And we realized, maybe we've got a quintessential disco thing here. And out of it, we got a huge hit. The rest of the album doesn't sound anything like Miss You. Then we had trouble with the cover. From Lucille Ball, of all people, who didn't want to be included. There were loads of lawsuits going on. On the original cover, you could pull out and change the faces with one of those cards. There was every famous woman in the world in there. Everybody we fancied. Lucille Ball? You don't like it? Fine. The feminists didn't like it either, you know. We always like to piss them off. Where would you be without us? And there is the offending line. Black girls just want to get fucked all night from some girls. Well, we've been on the road with a lot of black chicks for many years, and there's quite a few that do. Could have been yellow girls or white girls. I made a damn good attempt at cleaning up in 1977 with my Black Box and Meg Patterson and the rest, but for a brief time, it didn't stick. While working on Some Girls, I'd go to the John from time to time and shoot up. But it had its method. I'd think about what I was going to do in there. I'd be in there meditating about this track that was really nice, but only half finished, and where it could go, and what was going wrong with it, and why we'd done 25 takes and were still stumbling on the same block every time. When I came out, it was, listen, it goes a little faster, and we cut out the keyboards in the middle. And sometimes I was right. Sometimes I was wrong. But it had only been, 45 minutes. Better than 45 minutes when everybody is putting their oar in at once. Yeah, but what about if we do this? Which is, to me, murder. Very occasionally I would go on the nod while we were still playing. Still upright, but removed from present concerns, only to pick it up a few bars on. This did waste time, because the take, if there was one, would have to be scrapped. For sheer longevity, for long distance, There is no track that I know of, like Before They Make Me Run. That song, which I sang on that record, was a cry from the heart. But it burned up the personnel like no other. I was in the studio without leaving for 5 days. Worked the bars and sideshows along the Twilight Zone. Only a crowd can make you feel so alone. And it really hit home. Booze and pills and powders, you can choose your medicine. Well, here's another goodbye to another good friend. After all is said and done, gotta move while it's still fun. Let me walk before they make me run. It came out of what I'd been going through and was still going through with the Canadians. I was telling them what to do. Let me walk out of this goddamn case. When you get a lenient sentence, they say, oh, they let him walk. Why'd you keep nagging that song? Nobody likes it. Wait till it's finished. 5 days without a wink of sleep. I had an engineer called Dave Jordan. I had another engineer. And one of them would flop under the desk and have a few hours kip when I put the other one in and keep going. We all had black eyes by the time it was finished. I don't know what was so difficult about it. It just wasn't quite right. But then you get guys that'll hang with you. You'll be standing there with a guitar around your neck and everybody else is conked out on the floor. Oh, no, not another take. Keith, please. People brought in food, pan au chocolat. Days turned into nights. But you just can't leave it. It's almost there. You're tasting it. It's just not in your mouth. It's like fried bacon and onion. But you haven't eaten it yet. It just smells good. By the fourth day, Dave looked like he'd been punched in both eyes. And he had to be taken away. We got it, Dave. And somebody got him a taxi. He disappeared. And when we were finally finished, I fell asleep under the booth, under all this machinery. I woke up eventually. How many hours I never counted. And there's the Paris Police Band. A bloody brass band. That's what woke me up. They're listening to a playback. And they don't know I'm under there. And I'm looking at all these trousers with red stripes and La Marseillaise going on. And I'm wondering, when should I emerge? And I'm dying for pee. And I've got my shit with me, needles and stuff. And I'm surrounded by cops that don't know I'm there. So I waited a bit and thought, I'll just be very English. And I sort of rolled out and said, oh my God, I'm terribly sorry. And before they knew it, I was out. And they were all zootalorsing along, and there were about 76 of them. I thought, they're just like us. They're so intent on making a good record, they didn't bust me. When you get into it that much, you can lose the drive of it. But if you know it's there, it's there. It's manic, but it's like the Holy Grail. Once you're in, you're going to go for it. Because there's no turning back, really. You've got to come out with something, and eventually you get there. That's probably the longest I've done. There have been others that were close. Can't Be Seen was one. But Before They Make Me Run was the marathon. There's a postscript to these Some Girls sessions, which I should let Chris Kimsey tell. Miss You and Start Me Up were actually recorded on the same day. When I say on the same day, Miss You took about 10 days to get the final master, and then when it was done, they went and did Start Me Up. Start Me Up had been a reggae song recorded in Rotterdam 3 years earlier. When they started playing it this time, it wasn't a reggae song. It was what we know today as the great Start Me Up. It was Keith's song. He just changed it. Maybe after the disco thing of Miss You, he went to it with a different approach. And it was the only occasion I've ever recorded two masters on the same session. It didn't take long to get down. And when we got the take that everyone felt, ooh, that was good, Keith came in and listened to it, and he said, it's all right. It sounds like something I've heard on the radio. It should be a reggae song. Wipe it. He was still toying with it, but he didn't like it. I remember Keith saying at one point that he would prefer to wipe all the masters after they'd been done and released, so no one could go back and fiddle with them. So, of course, I didn't wipe it. And it became the big song on Tattoo You 3 years later. Once again, everything revolved around the stuff. Nothing could be done or organized without first organizing the next fix. It got more and more dire. Elaborate arrangements had to be made, some of them more comic than others. I had a man, James W., who I would call up when I was going from London to New York. I would stay at the Plaza Hotel. James, the sweet young Chinese man, would meet me in the suite, the big one preferably, and I'd hand him the cash and he'd give me the shit. And it was always very polite. Give my regards to your father. It was difficult in the 70s to get hypodermics in America. So when I travelled, I would wear a hat and use a needle to fix a little feather to the hat band, so it was just a hat pin. I would put the trilby with the red, green, and gold feather in the hat bag. So the minute James turned up, I got the shit. Okay, but now I need the syringe. My trick was, I'd order a cup of coffee, because I needed a spoon for cooking up. And then I'd go down to F.A.O. Schwartz, the toy shop, right across Fifth Avenue from the Plaza. And if you went to the third floor, you could buy a doctor and nurse playset, a little plastic box with a red cross on it. That had the barrel and the syringe that fitted the needle that I'd brought. I'd go round, I'll have three teddy bears, I'll have that remote control car. Oh, and give me two doctor and nurse kits. My niece, you know, she's really into that. Must encourage her. F.A.O. Schwartz was my connection. Rush back to the room, hook it up, and fix it. By then, I've ordered up coffee, so I've got the teaspoon. You fill the spoon and hold a lighter to it, and you watch it, and it should burn clear and turn to treacle. It shouldn't go black. That means there's too much cut in it. James never let me down on that. It was always high-quality stuff. I'm not looking for weight. I'm looking for sustenance. I'm strung out. I've got to have some dope, but never look for a huge amount, quarter ounces. Because also, the quality could change over a week or so. You don't want a whole bag of useless rotten dope. You watch the market. James W. was my man. Look, This is the best we've got right now. I don't suggest you buy any more of this. Next week, we're getting some high quality. Absolutely reliable was James. And a great sense of humour. Very straight up, straight business, price on the button. The only thing we'd laugh about was, have you been over to the toy store yet? Once you're a junkie, you smacks your daily bread. You don't really get off anymore that much. There's junkies that keep upping their dosage, and that's why you get ODs. To me, it just became maintenance. It was to set the trend for the day. Then came all those agonizing moments when there was a drought on, and the old lady's going, I want some stuff. So do I, honey, but we've got to wait. Waiting for the man. When there was a heroin drought, it was a bit rough. They really used to put the screws on. There'd be people in the room in dire straits, throwing up. You'd be treading over bodies. And there's sometimes really no drought. It's only to jack the price up. And it doesn't really matter how much money you've got. I'm not going to say, do you know who I am? I'm just another junkie. When there's no shit at all, then you've got to go down to the pits. And you know it's going to be like a fucking pool of piranhas down there. It happened to me a couple of times on the east side in New York and in L.A. We knew the trick. You'd score upstairs, and on your way down, the other bunch would take it back off of you again. Most of the time, you'd hear it going on while you were waiting for your turn. The thing was to leave quietly. And if you saw anybody outside, because you never knew if it was going to happen or not, usually you'd give them a kick in the balls. But a couple of times, fuck it. Okay, let's go for it. You cover me, you stay down there, and as I come down with the shit, I'll go bang, and they'll go bang, and then you go bang. Shoot out the light bulbs and put a few bullets around and do the run. Sparks flying. Then with a bit of luck, we're out of there. The statistics are well on your side against being hit when you're a moving target. If you look at the odds, 1,000 to 1, you're going to win. You have to be very close and you have to have good eyesight to shoot out a light bulb. And it's dark. Flash, bang, walloping, get out of there. I loved it. It was real OK Corral stuff. Only did it twice. It was a very time-consuming routine. I'd wake up in the morning, and the first thing is go to the bathroom to have a shot. You don't brush your teeth. And then, oh, fuck it. I've got to go to the kitchen and get the spoon. Those stupid rituals that you go through. Shit. Last night I should have brought a spoon up so that I didn't have to go down to the kitchen. Every time it got progressively harder and harder to kick. And the desire to go back on, the minute you were off, got stronger. Just one, now that I'm clean. Just that fatal one more, that celebration, is a killer. And on top of that, you've come out of it. You're off the stuff. But all your friends are junkies. If somebody cleans up, that somebody has escaped the circle. And whether they like you or love you or hate you or not, the first thing they want to do is to pull you back in. This is really good shit here. Certain pressures within junkiedom have it that if somebody cleans up and actually stays clean, it's like they failed somehow. Failed at what? I don't know. How many cold turkeys can you go through? It's ludicrous, but you never realize it when you're on dope. Several times on cold turkey, I was convinced that there was a safe behind the wall that was full of the shit, and it had everything ready to go, spoon and all. And finally, I'd crash out, and when I woke up, I'd see bloody fingernail marks down the wall where I'd actually been trying to get in there. Is this really worth it? In fact, my decision then was, yep. I can be as big-headed as Mick and flighty and everything, but you can't do that when you're a junkie. There are certain realities that come into play that really keep your feet in the gutter, even lower than you need to be. Not even on the sidewalk, in the gutter. And obviously that was the period when Mick and I went off on almost perfect 180s. He had no time for me in my supposedly stupid state. I remember being at a disco once in Paris, and I was supposed to meet the man, and I was sick. People were dancing around little glitter balls, and I'm under the benches, just hiding and throwing up because the man hasn't arrived. And I'm also wondering, will he find me under here? If he does arrive, he might look around and fuck back off. I was in a distressed frame of mind, let's put it like that. Luckily, he did find me, but being in that position, and at the same time, you're like numero uno in the world, you realize where you've sunk to. Just getting yourself in that position leaves a sense of self-loathing that takes a while to rub off. You son of a bitch, you'd do anything for this shit. But I'm my own man, I say. Nobody can tell me what to do. And yet, you realize you put yourself in the position where you're in the hands of a dealer. And that's disgusting. Waiting for this cunt and begging him? That's where the self-loathing comes in. Any way you look at it, junkies are people waiting for the man. Your world gets diminished to dope. Just that, by itself, becomes the whole world. Most junkies become idiots. That's really what finally turned me around. We've only got one subject in mind, which is the dope. Can't I be a little more smart about it? What am I doing hanging around with these dregs? They're just boring people. Worse, a lot of these are very bright people, and we all kind of know that we've been hoodwinked, but then, why not? Everybody else is hoodwinked by something, and at least we know we're fooling ourselves. No one's a hero just for taking dope. You might be a hero for getting off it. I loved the shit. But enough was enough. Also, it narrowed one's horizons. And eventually, all you know are junkies. I had to move to broader horizons. You only know all this, of course, once you've gotten out there. That's what that stuff does. It's the most seductive bitch in the world. The Canadian case went on and on. I was flying up and down from New York to Toronto on a weekly basis, but it didn't stop me taking the shit at the time. There was a little airport out of which I flew back to New York from Toronto on a private plane. On one of these trips in the airport before taking off, I went to the John to have a fix. I'm in the cubicle, and just as I'm cooking up the spoon, from beneath the door I see this ominous set of spurs. There's a fucking Mountie and the whole goddamn rig. He wants to take a pee, and he's gonna be smelling this dope. It's just flaring up. Clink, clink, and I'm a goner. And we're down the hole, and clink, 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 and the spurs walk out. How many chances have I got left? I'd pulled my string too long. There was already a permanent black cloud of expecting the shit to hit the fan. I'm facing three charges: trafficking, possession, and importing. I'm going to be doing some hard fucking time. I'd better get ready. Which is one of the reasons I finally cleaned up. I didn't want to go cold turkey in jail. I wanted to leave time for my nails to grow. They're the only weapons you're left with when you go to jail. Also, attached to the junk as I was putting myself slowly into a position where it would be impossible to move around the world and work. There was a tour coming up in 1 month. In June of 1978, for some girls, I knew I'd have to get clean for it. Jane Rose had been asking me, "When are you going to get clean?" And I'd say, "Tomorrow." I had done it the year before, fucked up, and gotten hooked again. And this was the last time. I didn't want to hear about another dope deal, been there. You get about 10 years and you stop. You take your medal and retire. And Jane stuck with me. Bless her fucking heart. The old Jugs, which is her nickname, came through. It must have been horrendous for her. Far worse for me. But for her to witness what goes on when you're climbing the walls, shitting yourself, going bananas, how could she plow through that? At this moment, the Stones were gathered at Bearsville Studios in Woodstock, New York, to rehearse for the tour. I was at home with Anita. Jane better tell the moment when I gave up heroin. I had basically become the courier. I would bring money or drugs from New York to Westchester County for Keith. He still wouldn't clean up, and his habit was bad now. And he would not admit it, and I couldn't stand the calls to Westchester anymore. I went up there, and Antonio and Anna Marie were there, friends of Anita's who lived in Keith's apartment in Rue Saint-Honoré in Paris. Antonio later became Antonia. So they were in the house, and Keith was waiting for money or drugs. Anita was there. I went up to the house, and they said, "Where's the money?" And I said, "I don't have the money." I said, "It's in New York." They flipped out, and Anita got in the car. She was furious. And I said, "Keith, today is tomorrow." Because he was always saying, "Tomorrow I'll clean up." And this was right before the tour in May. He and Anita had a huge fight later that day. Keith went upstairs. He was furious. Anna Marie and Antonio looked at this Jewish chick from New York and said, "This girl is gonna be dead. How could she come out here without the money?" Then there was silence, and I went upstairs to the bedroom, the four-poster bed, and I said, "Hello." And he had kicked off his shoes, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to do it. I've got my machine. I'm gonna kick." And I said, "Want to go to Woodstock? That's where the rehearsals are going to be. Get away. Do it. I'll go with you." And after 3 hours, he said, okay. So we were getting ready to go before Anita came back, because I just knew it had to be that way. And she came back before we left. There was a big row, and somebody went flying down the stairs. In the end, Keith sat in the car, and we went to Woodstock. Anita had her drugs or her money. And Keith went to Woodstock, and he went cold turkey with his machine. Mick and Jerry Hall came up for 2 days to be there with me. And I stayed with him 24 hours. I stayed in the room. I was there. I don't know for how many days after that, or if I even talked to anybody. I had a conviction that he was going to get better. I just believed in him. If you want to get something out of anybody, I'd say put them on dope for a month or two and just withdraw it, and they'll talk. Jane got me through the 72 hours. She watched me climb the walls, which is why I don't like wallpaper anymore. You're barely able to control your muscle spasms. And you're really ashamed of yourself. And you've got to do it. I didn't go back for another shot because after coming out of there, I just locked myself in a room. Jane was with me. And Jane just cleaned me up. And that was the last time. I ain't going there again. Anita, on the other hand, was no help. She wouldn't do the deal. If we're going to stay together, we've got to do it together. And she didn't. We were spinning out of control. By now, I couldn't live in the house with somebody who was still on junk. It's a chemical reaction to the body, but it's also in your relationship to other people. That's where the difficult bit is. I would have stayed with Anita probably forever, but when it came to that very important time when dope was out of the picture from now on, she didn't stop. She'd never stopped, in fact. When we did it for several months in 1977, she'd be sneaking stuff round the back. I knew that she was on it. You can just tell by the eyeballs. So now I couldn't even go and see her. And that was where I said, oh, well, that's Anita. That's where it blew. I was clean, and we were rehearsing for the 1978 tour in Woodstock, New York, at Bearsville Studios. One day, out of the clouds, by helicopter, there came Lil. She had come with her friend Joe Wood, Ronnie's soon-to-be wife, for Woody's birthday. It was about 10 days before we went on the road, and it was almost miraculous timing to find such a new friend. Her real name is Lil Virgilis, although she's always been written about as Lil Wenglass or Lil Green, her married name. Sweet as she is, although she was more of a London girl than you'd believe after a decade there, and talked like one. Ah, fucking naff and all that. She was a brilliant Swedish blonde in the bloom of her life. When I first met Lil, she was like Marilyn Monroe. Dazzling. Pink lurex tights and blonde hair. But she was also very smart and strong-hearted. She was a lovely girl, a beautiful lover, and I just got off the stuff and Lil came along and made me laugh. She laughed me out of it. She really brought me out of the abyss. It's not so easy to kick that shit as I pretend it is. After 10 years on the stuff and 5 or 6 cold turkeys, and staying off the stuff is another thing, and Lil, bless her heart, took my mind off it totally. We just fell into each other's arms for a year or so. We had a great time together. Lil was like a breath of fresh air. Light-hearted, loads of fun, outrageous, up for anything. Incredibly funny, very witty, and a great lay. She was energetic. She did things, like cook breakfast and make sure I was up on time. And I needed a bit of that. Not popular with Mick. Not your Studio 54 girl was Lil. He couldn't think what I was doing with her. It was a turbulent time for our marriages or non-marriages. Bianca had sued him for divorce. He now had Jerry Hall on his arm, and I got on well with Jerry. I took Lil on tour with me, where she was my accomplice in another of my fate-cheating close shaves. The list now too long to be taken lightly. This time, it was from fire in our rented house in Laurel Canyon, L.A. Lil and I had gone to bed, and Lil, so she said later, heard this distant bang and got up and opened the curtains a little, and it was strangely bright outside. Not right. She opened the bathroom door and fire exploded into the room. And we had a few seconds to jump out of the window. I'm dressed in a short t-shirt only and Lil is naked. We're exposed. People are gathered, freaking out, trying to put the fire out. And this is a big story as soon as the press gets here. Up pulls a car and we get in gratefully. Amazingly, it's a cousin of Anita. We are in a state of shock. We go to her house, borrow some clothes, go to a hotel. The next day, someone went round to have a look, and there was a large sign stuck in the blackened grass that read, "Thanks a lot, Keith." My trial was finally heard in Toronto in October 1978. We knew it might sink us all, but in the face of it, some of us were looking on the bright side. "I don't think it's going to be as bad as that," said Mick. "You've got to say, if the worst happens and Keith gets put in an open prison with Mrs. Trudeau for life, that I'm still going to go on the road. Maybe we could play a tour of Canadian prisons. Ha, ha, ha." The longer the process went on, the clearer it was that the Canadian government wanted to wriggle out of it. The Mounties and their allies were thinking, "Oh, great, wonderful job. We've delivered him to the Canadian government with a hook in his mouth." And the Trudeaus were thinking, pal, this is the last thing we need." There were 500 to 600 people outside every time I turned up in court, chanting, "Free Keith, free Keith." And we knew that the enemy camp, if you want to call the Canadian government at the time the enemy, our persecutors, were unsure of their footing. Whereas I didn't mind. I figured the harder they hit me, the easier I would get out. The Mounties, or at least the prosecution, didn't want to wriggle out at all. But, as Bill Carter observed, in almost every one of these cases brought against us at that time, the law had its hands dirty. They knew I wasn't trafficking, but they wanted to railroad it through a jury to get a long and historic jail sentence. There, they made a mistake. Look at Keith Richards. He's not selling drugs. He's got all the money he needs. The allegation of trafficking, just to get a stiff sentence, is absurd. He's a hopeless addict. He has a medical problem. My lawyers wrote a report that showed that According to all the legal precedent and local case histories, if I weren't Keith Richards, I would probably have gotten no more than a suspended sentence.